Welcome to the MERS Monday podcast. I am MERS publisher John Roerink. I am joined by Jacob Kanzler, Lauren Gibbons, and Simon Schuster. Today is, what did you say it was? Hug a media person day today?
Hug a newsman or hug a newsman.
Hug a news person.
News person would be the right PC way to phrase that, right?
Either way, journalists.
It might be AP style.
Either way, everybody should go out. They should find a news person and give them a hug.
Journalists need lots of hugs
these days. Love, too.
We do.
On that point, let's share the love a little bit about some things that are going on specifically with relations to the state legislature and the city of Flint. News Friday that the city of Flint had filed a claim, a piece of paper in the court of claims that preserves for them the right to file suit against the state. Lauren, what does that do as sort of the lawmakers continue to work on this issue? Does it help the mayor and the city of Flint? Does it hurt them in sort of what they're trying to do?
So essentially, the mayor says that this is purely a technical move, but if it does anything going forward, I can see this potentially hurting negotiations between the state and city, just because any time there's a threat of a lawsuit, there is technically, you know, kind of an adversarial background here. And so even though the city is claiming that this was a technical move, this is to preserve the rights of the residents as they move forward, and if they feel the need at any point to sue the state for the Flint water crisis, that's kind of where they're coming from. But they didn't make the state aware that they were doing this before it happened, and so it kind of struck everybody as a surprise when this news came out on Friday. And so the state is having some difficulty understanding the rationale for putting this out there and kind of creating an adversarial relationship when their perspective is that they've been doing everything they can. As soon as the Flint water crisis came to light, they've been giving money, they've been giving assistance, they've been declared the state of emergency, they're trying to put something through the appropriations process. And so from the administration's perspective, this is not good, not good at all. And they also, I should also point out that they they claim that the notice wouldn't be legally valid because if they're going from the beginning of the Flint water crisis, that would have started in April 2014, and there's a notice would have to be given within 6 months of the event. So there's another issue that the state and city clearly disagree pretty strongly on.
Yeah, I was a little surprised over the weekend. Some of the reaction that I got was from folks that was, here we have one tax-funded entity, taxpayer-funded entity, suing another. Why not just sit around the table, Jacob, and work it out?
Yeah, and I mean, and that's a good point. And you know, Lauren brought up a good point too. I mean, the state has, you know, a reason to be maybe a little threatened by this. And the term that comes to me is, you don't bite the hand that feeds. You know, the state has been, objectively trying to help out any way they can, sending money and kind of engaging everything in the past few months. But the other point that we mentioned, we talked about earlier, you know, how does this hurt Mayor Weaver? And, you know, besides maybe the breakdown in trust and maybe an increasing of distrust between levels of government, I don't know long term if it will affect her, because it just stands to say that not helping out Flint right now would be extremely politically inconvenient. I mean, this is a legitimate public health catastrophe. I don't think the state can just cut off all of its resources. So Mayor Weaver is in a considerable point of power. She's gotten a lot of the things she's wanted the past few months. We could go off a list right now. But so this is going to be a little bit of a blip in the relationship. But I think that, you know, things will eventually recover. And I don't think this will hurt her or Flint long term.
She still holds the cards with this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, the legislature is going to try to put strings on things and try to be diligent with whatever funding they send there, but no one's going to just cut off everything to Flint.
As angry as the state or the legislature might be, not helping Flint recover from the Flint water crisis
is not an option. Right.
Yep.
Right. We had other news last week on Thursday, sort of one of the questions hanging over the state Senate sort of came to a conclusion, Lauren.
Not quite, almost.
Right. We got another week. Yes. Senator Virgil Smith turned in his letter of resignation, and he gets to collect a paycheck for a little while longer.
Yes, his resignation is effective April 12th. So he's got a few more days here to get the paycheck from jail. Once the legislature comes back into session, though, obviously Senator Smith will no longer be there and will no longer be a member of the chamber.
It helps them avoid a vote they really didn't want to take, though, did they?
Right, right. They initially were saying, you know, let's let the legal process work itself out. Almost a year at this point. We're talking April. The incident happened in late May. So it was almost a year where the legislature said, let's see how the legal process played out. And then when it became pretty clear that the legal process wasn't going to end with Senator Smith resigning at this point. So then some pressures were inserted and the majority leader made it clear that he would begin the expulsion process.
We will pull the trigger.
Right. And, you know, it's not something that anyone necessarily wanted to go through. So, you know, here he is resigning in a few days.
Simon, you also did a couple of very in-depth analysis pieces for MERS this past week. Let's start with the 8th Congressional District, where we've got U.S. Representative Mike Bishop facing off against Melissa Gilbert. What did you find out? These two, actually, the campaigns have some similarities, don't they?
Yes, and it is largely that both of them have significant sources of outside funding. Melissa Gilbert's campaign is being funded 52% from donors within the state of California. And there's some big names in there, Sean Penn, Alec Baldwin, Florence Henderson even. And these are people that she's known from her time in Hollywood and working in film and television. But Mike Bishop, on the other hand, he's largely being funded by interest groups. 58% of his funding is coming from committees, and about a third of his overall funding is coming from committees located in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. In other words, the Beltway. So for a first-term representative, this isn't going to play that well to have this level of Washington insider money.
So California versus Washington, we'll see who wins.
Melissa Gilbert's campaign is certainly star-studded, but Mike Bishop's is certainly studded with PACs as well. And so likely the messaging will probably avoid both of these issues altogether, but Bishop's campaign has indicated they're certainly going to continue hammering Gilbert on the issue of her unpaid back taxes.
Yeah, we'll see how that plays. You also did another analysis with Kyle on Friday, sort of looking at our March 3rd presidential primary here in Michigan and how that played out across 20 vulnerable districts. And what did you find?
We found that although Republicans had significantly more participation in the primary, about 277,000 to Democrats 193,000, Sanders still carried the day in terms of raw votes. We saw a Republican Party that is still very much fractured. Trump never took a majority in any of these districts, and it's really going to be key as we move towards the convention this summer that the Republican Party decides to coalesce around a candidate. And if there is a contested convention, it's going to perhaps mean bad news for the representatives who are in these districts.
All right, next we're going to turn to some education issues as Jacob has an interview with the State Board of Education President, John Austin.
John, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning.
All right, John, there's been the State Board of Education and the Department of Education have been in the news lately with lawmakers. The first thing I want to talk to you about here is the guidance paper that was made public by the Department of Education regarding supportive and safe learning environments for LGBTQ students. But let's just start off with, what do you make of the reactions that lawmakers had when they learned of this document and kind of the backlash that has resulted from it since then?
Well, first, we should appreciate our job, our collective job, really, is to make sure all our kids are getting a great education. And when we were hearing from school districts and educators that, you know, they wanted some additional best practice guidance from the state on what they could do to make sure the significant number, you know, it's almost 9% of our gay kids and a growing number of kids who are transgender and who are more comfortable in being who they are, they have real obstacles to having a safe and supportive learning environment, and they're more at risk of taking their own lives if they're feeling unwelcomed or not acknowledged, and they're not performing as well in school if they're not engaged or they're skipping class or they're not feeling safe. So this is an important educational issue, and we do what we always do, engage some of the best experts in education and mental health and youth services. Lots of school districts, as you've seen the coverage begin to be more thoughtfully informed, are already animating some of the supportive policies that help these kids be acknowledged and feel safe and have a place to go to the bathroom that's comfortable for them and other students. So it is very important for our education and also what kind of message that we want to send as a state. Are we sending a message that we welcome all and support to great learning and life outcomes, all our kids, whatever color they are, whatever sexual orientation they have? Or are we continuing to deny they exist or ostracize them, which really sends a message that's bad for the state and not the kind of messages we're seeing in North Carolina, that business leaders and others who want to support great education and embrace and attract top talent. We want to be a state that's educating all our kids and embracing and celebrating diversity in all its forms. So I think it's an unfortunate backlash to legislate sexuality, which is both not right, disabling, really stigmatizing transgender folks in particular, and it violates the civil rights expectations that we all have. These kids deserve a great education and deserve a supportive environment as best we can give it at school.
I want to see, so obviously there has been some opposition voice to these, and you've heard these, and I want to give you a chance to address for our listeners head on maybe some of these, some concerns that lawmakers have brought up. They've mentioned how parental consent or inform, you know, how they're informed about these decisions. You know, people have alleged that this guidance would leave them out in the dark. There's the fear out there of which students can use which bathrooms. Can you just walk us through a little bit about what this policy document does and does not do with regards to those issues?
And we should appreciate that these are, again, voluntary recommendations based on successful efforts to help all these kids feel comfortable and focus on learning, where local school communities can, and we're encouraging them to engage with their parents and engage with the kids around these important issues of what their names can be at school and what everybody having access to a safe place to go to the bathroom. I think on some of the particulars, you know, we all hope, and many parents are supportive of their young people if they're gay or if they're transgender. And we are specifically saying school personnel, parents, students, figure out together how you can and what kind of policies you want to call that student by the right name. But we also have to appreciate that there may be some families, hopefully most families are supportive of their transgender students, but some may not be. And those kids still need a welcoming environment at school. It's very challenging if they're not supported at home, but they can. No one can change someone's name unilaterally for a minor. Many schools that are succeeding with these students, and what we're encouraging in the guidance for every school to figure out themselves, you know, respect them and call them by a nickname if that's their preferred identity at school, and support them with the kind of understanding that can be built and encouraged among all the teachers and faculty of what these kids are experiencing. And you know, for many of these kids, it is a real life and death issue. If you're denying that they exist, our schools need to be a safe haven, irrespective of what challenges they may face at home. Our kids, our schools need to take them as they are and provide the kind of nurturing environment that helps them not be at risk of taking their own life and be able to focus on learning. So we do encourage and we hope that all parents will be appreciative of their transgender kids and want to work with schools on the right names and the right protocols for how those kids should be treated at school. But if they don't, it's these kids' civil right to still have a welcoming environment at school that respects them, who they are. It's also the civil right that's expected under federal law that treats transgender students in particular as that they do exist. And we've always had transgender people among us. We need to create an environment that supports them and helps them learn as well. We also, on the bathroom policy, again, I think there's some real misunderstanding and even fear-mongering. Transgender students are not a menace to others. We're again encouraging each school community to work out a policy as it sees fit to help our transgender students have a safe place to go to the bathroom. Often that is having a gender-neutral bathroom that's private that they can use. They are more concerned about whether they are going to pass as their gender identity, not menacing other students. But we also want the other students to feel comfortable. Many school communities, the kids and the families and the school will be comfortable in having transgender students use the bathroom of their choice. It's also their civil right of their gender that they are identifying as. School communities that have problems with that, let's work out a solution and let's let the local communities do it. Again, we're seeing state legislation of which bathroom you get to use based on your birth gender sends a not only wrong, illegal, but also really disturbing message that we're not acknowledging these young people. We don't accept them. They're already struggling with their identity and whether they will be accepted. And that kind of message, again, state dictate, is that what we want? Our guidance says let the local school communities work out a bathroom policy that works for the straight kids, works for the gay kids, works for the transgender kids. And as we're seeing across Michigan, it can be done. Many schools are figuring this out, and the kids are engaged in learning and thriving and getting a great education, and that's what we want to see and encourage to happen again on a voluntary basis. We don't need state dictates on sexuality or bathroom use, and that's why I would caution, again, the legislature, do you really want to send a message like North Carolina that's provoking another backlash, which is business folks, leaders saying, we do not want to do business with a state that is legislating sexuality and gender identity. Let's let local school communities work with their parents and with their kids and work out a way to support these kids. All kids need a safe place to go to the bathroom and a great education, and this is the kind of guidance that is desired by our school communities, and they'll figure out how to make it work for, in their particular context.
Last question on this before I move to the other big issue here. As you probably know, a House Appropriations Subcommittee moved to take away the travel stipends for you and the other board members citing this policy. What is your reaction to that, and does that change kind of where you guys want to go on this issue because of that?
No, that's kind of silly and petty. I mean, we're doing our job. We're elected statewide by the people of Michigan to provide some leadership and some supervision over all public education with the goal of helping all our kids, whether they're black or Latino or gay or trans, get a great education. And we are moving forward and listening to the public discussion. I think the public discussion will help us make clear that these kids have obstacles to their learning. They have obstacles to their mental health if they're not accepted and supported, much more at risk of suicide, much more at risk of not engaging with school and not getting good grades and being homeless, dropping out or skipping class. And our job is to create an environment in all our schools where all our kids can thrive. And so this isn't important. This isn't about politics or, you know, gotcha games for either side. This is about helping all our kids get a great education, which is our job, and we're doing our job.
John, the other issue that came up here this week or this month is the lawmakers have proposed to go away from the M-STEP test, which is fairly new. It's be starting its second year here in the state of Michigan. And now I've covered the State Board of Ed and the Department of Education for a couple of years now. I know this isn't the first time that the legislature has moved to kind of remove a test that had been kind of been prepared and worked on by the Department of Ed. What do you make of this most recent issue? Is it really time to move away from the M-STEP, or you know, are lawmakers making too early of a move on a test that's still fairly new?
Well, again, we need some statewide assessment that tells us whether the kids are learning the standards in math and language arts and science that we've set out for all our schools to deliver and help all our kids get a great education. There are some, and I don't think that's the case in this instance, there are some who are against a common set of statewide learning standards. That led to the prior efforts to sort of take away an assessment because people didn't like the common high math, language arts, and now science and history standards. There's great frustration, understandable, with the time it takes to take these tests. I think that we are streamlining. Our superintendent has made it clear we're going to streamline and reduce the time of whatever state-required assessments, including the M-STEP, are delivered. But basically, we want an assessment that is linked to what we're asking our teachers to teach the kids in school. And so whatever that assessment is that aligns with those content expectations, that's what we all would support. And if it's something different or better than the M-STEP, but we don't want to take away. The M-STEP was designed to test what we're asking schools and educators to teach our kids, our highest rigorous standards that are what kids need to succeed at their next steps, whether it's work or college or going on in life. And we don't want to give a test that doesn't test what we're asking our teachers to teach in school. That's nonsensical and certainly would be to drive educators crazier. So we need to streamline the assessment. We need to agree, and let's keep working to make the assessment time be as efficient and limited as possible, but so we have some marker that we know as policymakers whether the kids in Grand Blanc or in Grosse Pointe or in Monroe or Marquette are learning the kind of content so we can, educators can help rejigger, and we can support efforts to help our kids learn and thrive at the same high level.
Jumping off that, one of the more specific proposals that have been floated instead of the M-STEP is just grabbing what is called an off-the-shelf test. In other words, a test that is already designed and ready to go. Based on what you said in terms of having a test that is designed to meet Michigan's standards, would you say that you are against that specific idea in terms of an M-STEP replacement by grabbing just a off-the-shelf test that is not specifically designed for what Michigan teaches?
Yeah, I would oppose that. If there is an off-the-shelf test that tracks very perfectly our learning content standards, which are quite good and quite rigorous and what we do want our kids to learn so they can succeed in their next step in life and college, then great. But if, again, it makes no sense to expect our teachers to teach one set of content and have an assessment that tests something very different. That's a recipe for additional frustration, headache, and it doesn't help us track whether kids are actually learning what we want them to learn, which is the skills they need to succeed in the post-secondary learning environments and the work of tomorrow.
All right. Finally, John, I know that you are running again for the State Board of Education post up in November, and I know that you know you've been out and been releasing some more statements and kind of increasing your presence here, you know, on Twitter and elsewhere. And my question for you is: do you have aspirations to run for a different office, a higher office besides the Board of Education at this point?
Well, we're going to make a more formal announcement of my candidacy for re-election to the State Board of Education, and I do want to provide, you know, continued leadership on how we rebuild, really, our support for great public education and how we put higher education in reach of all our young people, which I've also been a leader in those efforts. And I do want to make this campaign year, you know, kind of referendum on what kind of state we want. Is it one that really reorganizes the way we finance and organize public schools so that our learning outcomes are much higher, and that we're helping all our young people to get a ticket to a great higher education? This year we'll have a presidential campaign, and I'm going to be the top statewide elected official on the ballot, and we should have a good public discussion, and I want to help lead it about how we need to rebuild support for great learning outcomes, how we need to make higher education accessible.
That wraps up this edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I'm MERS publisher John Roering. Thank you to Jacob Kanzler, Lauren Gibbons, Simon Schuster, and State Board of Education President John Austin. Until next week.